This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Preborn. We want to save 300 babies' lives by giving their moms free ultrasounds, and you can help. Your gift of $140 will give free ultrasounds to five young women. Please help by calling 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or go to preborn.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. There is perhaps nobody today who has stated his vitriol toward God more plainly than new atheist Richard Dawkins. Remember this quote from Dawkins, quote, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, capriciously malevolent bully." And I left some of those adjectives out because I can't bear to read the whole thing. But this is not a view held by Richard Dawkins alone. We know it is flat out wrong. It absolutely massacres the truth about who God really is and what his character is really like and what he has done for us by his grace through his son, Jesus Christ. So how do we, by the grace of God, help skeptics like Dawkins solve what could be called their God problem? That's what we're going to talk about today with former skeptic and now pastor Mark Clark. He is the founding pastor of Village Church in Vancouver, Canada, and author of the book we'll be discussing. It's called The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. Mark, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be with you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think this is fascinating. I was reading through the intro in your book, and in some ways, I'd say you're sort of an unlikely pastor. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I was raised in a non-Christian home, very ardently atheistic, agnostic family, no church, no Bible, no God. And ended up, first time I ever walked into a church, I was 19. And over the years became a pastor and then planted a church 7 years ago here in Vancouver. So pretty unlikely. Once my parents got divorced, I actually acquired, I talked about in the intro of the book, acquired Tourette syndrome, which caused me to kind of, swear randomly and do all kinds of habits. So you tend not to become a pastor when you, swear randomly at people.
True. Good point.
Anyways, pretty unlikely. Yeah, I kind of grew up in the, the non-Christian social world and drugs and the whole scene. And then met Jesus at 17 and kind of studied the Bible by myself before ever walking into a church when I was 19, and had to wrestle through kind of all the questions that I talk about in the book, these top 10 questions that I think real skeptics wrestle through, and had to wrestle through those myself.
Yes. So. Yeah. And you say you researched, you went through, kind of wrestling with some of these problems about God, the existence of God and those sorts of things. Was there one particular problem you had with God that superseded the others that really gave you the most trouble?
I always kind of wrestled with, my father passed away when I was 15, and so he was 47. I hadn't seen him in a couple of years and kind of never got an opportunity to say goodbye to him. He never even called us and kind of told us he was sick. So standing over his casket at his funeral, probably 18 people there, and I'm looking and I'm asking the big questions. And so here was someone who didn't become a Christian, so the problem of hell was probably a big one for me, and the idea of just this felt really disjointed. So that one was big for me, and it's a very personal question, obviously, for me with my family and my father passing away without knowing Jesus. So I had to wrestle through that one a bunch. And then probably just God's existence by itself, and whether this, does he actually exist, and what proofs or evidences do we have of that? So those are probably the two that stood out for me as I wrestled through it.
Yeah, I'm very sorry about your loss. That's a very difficult thing to lose your dad. So when you are going from an atheistic household and you do eventually become a Christian and you do embrace the existence of God, looking back, do you have any insight onto what made you reject the existence of God? In other words, putting on the skeptic's clothes and going back to where you were, was it just kind of a default position because that was the worldview of your family? Or did you, the shift, I think, is what interests me so much. How did you go from there is no God to yes, there is?
Right. Well, the default position of, we all grow up kind of with a narrative around us, right, that we pick up from whether it's media or family sitting around the dinner table. And so it wasn't really something that we talked about. We never prayed. We never had a Bible. We never talked about God. Never went to church. So for me, it was, you know, just the default setting was, this isn't something I think about. I don't really, you know, I'm a kid. I'm living life and whatever. So I think we all have those presuppositions, and we don't just naturally go and doubt our doubts. We don't go and challenge. We don't know what we don't know. And so I don't think we just kind of go, oh, maybe I should think about the deepest existential questions of the universe. You know, we're 9 years old running around the neighborhood. If your family's not causing you to do that. So that, you know, that for me wasn't something until I went to summer camp as a kid. Once my parents got divorced, my grandfather sent me to a Christian summer camp. And that's when I first heard of this gospel, the idea of Jesus, you know, and it fascinated me. And so I'd get interested in it, and then I would come back and, you know, live the disaster of a life as a high school kid, you know, doing drugs, stealing, partying, doing all the things you do without Jesus in your life. And that was, so that was probably a bit of the shift, was being introduced to the concept of God there, but really kind of wrestling with, I think one of the reasons that kept me away from it, to be honest, was, just, and when I talk to normal people, it's not like the regular Joe on the street has, you know, 1,000 philosophical reasons why he might not be a Christian. Mm-hmm. It's stuff like he's living life.
True.
And he's got his pleasure, he's got his thing, and it's uncomfortable to ask the massive philosophical questions about origins, meaning, morality, and destiny, and start to think, man, if I got to, you know, here I am, I'm 30 years old, I have a rhythm, I have a family, I have a job, I have a way of doing things, I have a worldview, whether I know it or not. And now if I ask these massive questions and I got to deal with it, now there's like, I got to change stuff. You know,
right,
and so we're, in a sense, sometimes we're enslaved to our own kind of pleasures and just the rhythm of our life to go, you know, I don't know if I just want to ask these massive questions because it's going to mean different things for my money, different things for my sexuality, different ways that I use my family, you know, I do family and all the rest of it. So sometimes I think it's just that.
Yes, I think you're right. I know a lot of people that say that, yeah, if I became a Christian, that would be a real hassle because then I'd have to do this and that and all the rest. But see,
Totally.
But you have a church that welcomes skeptics, and I want to get into all these problems that you outline in the book, but I'm interested about this because you welcome skeptics, you welcome cynics. Obviously, you have a heart for these people because you were one of them at one time. What sorts of questions are these questions derived from the questions you get from those who come to your church?
Yes. Yeah. So these are the questions that have arisen through lots of conversations with the regular Joes on the street and friends and family and people I know. And these are the people who are coming and saying, hey, I don't want to believe in Christianity, and here's why. So people who have actually thought through it, you know, maybe different than the people we were just talking about, who haven't really thought through it, they just kind of get into they're reading the cultural teleprompter of just like, whatever, I'm just living my life. And then there's people who have actually go, no, I actually have reasons why I don't, you know, proactively don't believe in Christianity. And these are the ones that they bring, and they say, you know, the reason I can't believe in this is because of hell, or the reason I can't believe in this is because science, or the reason I can't believe in this is because of you know, one of the chapters is on sex. You know, people go, the view of the Bible on sex and what it calls me out for, you know, this is why I don't accept Christianity, or the exclusivity, or evil and suffering, and so on. So these are the things that people are bringing me, that over coffees and having conversations with them, these are the reasons. And then if you can try to provide some answers, it causes them to go back and go, okay, I gotta come up with another reason now.
Right. I can imagine. Yes. I've talked to a few people like that too. I know exactly what you're talking about. And you know, it's interesting when you described it the way you just did, where they say, well, I don't want to have to change my views on sex, or I don't want to have to change my views on hell, or what have you. What you really are after, and what we think about when we talk to people who are not believers in Jesus Christ, is, but this is what God thinks. This is what God says. Is there a sense in which you have to deal with that authority issue before you deal with all the rest of it?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I think when it comes to, you know, for instance, the issue of hell, it's more, as I talk about in the book, it's more of a repulsion probably than it is a logical reason not to believe in God. We just don't like the idea of it. Now, what I talk about is, I think you don't like the idea of it probably just because you're a product of ethnocentricity, meaning you're part of the modern Western Starbucks drinking, sit around, drink lattes, and choose what you like and don't like in the nature of your comfortable place, where the rest of the world that lives in violence and awfulness says, if there isn't a hell, if there isn't a judgment, maybe God's not worth worshiping.
Wow. Well, we're going to pick up the discussion. Mark Clark, his book, The Problem of God. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today right after this.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, an estimated 24.7 million children live without their biological father. Sadly, this disproportionately affects minority communities. And the effects of this reality are heartbreaking. Children in father-absent homes are almost four times more likely to be poor. They're more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, have physical and emotional health problems, and more than twice as likely to commit suicide. This is why we must persist in our support for marriage and families. During our summer of persistence, Concerned Women for America recommits to founding principles that have sustained our freedom throughout our nation's history. Please join in.
Now is not the time to resist. Now is the time to persist for faith, family, and freedom. This summer, find out how you can support a positive agenda that protects our country's biblical values at CapitolHillBrief.org. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. Janet Mefford Today and Preborn are partnering to save 300 babies' lives this summer.
Well, my name is Dan Steiner, and I'm the president of Preborn. Ultrasound truly is a game changer. When a mom comes into a pregnancy center under pressure to abort her child, perhaps the dad's gone, perhaps her mother is pressuring her. Most of the time in her heart, she doesn't want to abort, but what she needs is something that will give her the strength to choose life against the pressures that are forcing her to consider abortion. That's the ultrasound. If she hears her baby's heartbeat and sees that baby on ultrasound, everything's different. 80% of the time, she'll choose life.
Will you join us in saving babies' lives? A $140 sponsorship gives five babies a chance at life, and you'll get a picture of the babies' lives that were saved. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now 855-601-BABY or 855-601-2229 or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. So glad you're here and so glad to have Mark Clark with us, founding pastor of Village Church in Vancouver, Canada, and author of The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. You were making the point, Mark, before we went to the break there, that you do have the Starbucks crowd that says, well, I'll take this and not that, and then tries to apply it to eternal truth. So let's dive into some of these problems that you outline. One is fundamentally the problem of science. We hear this a lot. Faith and science don't go together. If you are a Christian, you reject science. But we know science is authoritative. How do you begin to work people through that problem and explain why faith and science do not conflict?
I think part of it is the recognition that as the deeper science goes into the things of the universe, whether it's astronomy or biology, it actually keeps pointing people toward God. So as Leslie Newbegin pointed out years ago, there's more atheists in the humanities than there are in the sciences in regard to university disciplines and faculties and so on. Because, you know, if you're sitting around reading and doing English literature or whatever, then you're probably, you know, you might be more apt to be an atheist than if you're dealing with DNA strands, you know. And so the idea that, you know, when Darwin was doing observational science, he didn't have DNA to look at. He didn't know that every strand of DNA was encoded with an encyclopedia worth of logical information. And once you start discovering that, then you start realizing, man, what caused this? There seemed to be a mind before there was matter versus the evolutionary story, which is matter over time created mind.
Right.
And so I think the deeper science goes into astronomy, the more we learn about the universe, it actually starts to point toward an intelligent mind that created this kind of stuff. So I think that, you know, you're basically getting to a point now where it's more rational to believe in a God than to not.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that they have been, in many respects, conditioned to believe that if you ever run into a Christian, that person rejects science and is kind of stupid. Do you find that a lot? That, like, you're a Christian, you must be stupid. You must not have any brains in your head.
Exactly. Exactly. You have rational, reasonable people, and then you have people who believe Christianity because they want some comfort, you know, in their life. And like we just talked about, tell that to the university student. Tell that to the 19-year-old in high school that the only reason they believe in Christianity is just because of the comfort it brings them. It's like, no, actually, flip it around. I actually think people don't believe. I mean, it's harder to try to follow Jesus when you're 19 full of hormones.
Yes. Amen.
You know, 19-year-old kid in high school, right?
So right.
It's like, there's a cost to this. This isn't for the comfort. Sometimes I look around and I see, you know, in my culture, certainly in Canada, there's this, like, what you believe is true, what I believe is true, what everybody believes is true, so let's just move on with life so we can have a good turkey dinner and not argue as a family or something. And everyone has this kind of relativistic. I actually think that's the cop-out. That's the worldview that says, I want to be comfortable.
Yes, for sure.
Worldview that goes, no, let's actually delve into something that might be right and wrong, and we differ on this, and now things come uncomfortable. We say, okay. So I actually think the Christian worldview is the least comfortable of.
Absolutely. And even if you have a kid who really wants to follow Jesus and is trying to stay on the narrow way, you're surrounded by kids who aren't. That's not a comfortable situation.
Yeah, right.
You feel very alone at times. So, yeah, absolutely.
Totally. Yeah.
Well, let's hit on the morality thing, because when you talk about the problem of God's existence, you also have another section on the problem of sex. This all comes together. The minute you say Canada, I start thinking of all the stories that have been coming out of your country that I cover on my show, talking about, you know, homosexuality and all the rest. This is a huge issue right now, especially for Generation Z coming up and the millennial generation. How do you deal with this when you say, yes, there is a God. Yes, he does have a law. Yes, he has set in place male and female. When you're in a world like ours, as a pastor, how do you talk to skeptics about these issues and about how God thinks about these issues?
Well, I think it comes back to what you were saying before the break, which is it's an authority issue. So if a couple comes in and they want to get married, and one of them's a Christian, one of them's not a Christian, I don't just kind of sit with them and say, hey, listen, I can't marry you because, you know, hey, I don't like you, or I'm in a bad mood. I say, look, I can't marry you. And then when the non-Christian goes, well, wait a minute, I say, well, let me show you why.
Yeah.
And I opened up the Bible and I say, here's a passage about not being unequally yoked. So in this moment, hey, Tom, I really like you, but I actually have an authority, a narrative that I have to live under. And so if you're going to get mad at something, don't get mad at me. I'm not just making stuff up. I actually have to live under this book and what it says about life. And so I do the same with our city, where I say, here's the biblical view of marriage. And I'm not making this stuff up. I actually have to live under this version of male and female, married, sexuality only in this context. Because this is the authority I live under. I don't get to set the rules and pick and choose. And so once people at least see that you're trying to be honest with the Bible and you're trying to live under it, then I think they're willing to have the conversation. But if all they see you as is kind of a product of some kind of, you know, cultural politics or something, and that's why you have this view because you were raised like this, then I think they're less willing to go, okay, I see what you're doing. You're trying to come under this book that's defining reality for you. And at least, I mean, they can read, so they know what the Bible says about this stuff. Right. You know, we're not making it up.
Right.
So I think pointing them toward the authority of the Bible is very crucial.
Is there a lot that you encounter in the way of skeptics saying, I don't want to capitulate to the God of the universe as you describe him to me, Mark, because I don't want to change, as you said before, I don't want to change the way I live. But also, furthermore, I don't want to change what I believe about morality. Maybe specifically, I don't want to change what I believe about sexuality. Does that ever come into play in your discussions?
Well, I think it's what's going on. I don't necessarily think people would articulate it like that.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure they're that self-aware.
Probably not.
To be able to go, you know, this is why I'm actually afraid to change, you know, over the, you know, to become a kingdom person in the world. Maybe in the back of their brain, once they've lived 10 or 20 years in a culture and then they see the church's stance on sexuality, maybe part of their deterrent is, you know what, if I believe this, I know where this is going to go.
True.
This is going to go me having to adopt a biblical view of sexuality. And now at work, things become weird. And now this becomes weird. And I just can't do it. And so it actually makes them afraid.
Mm. Yes,
but they don't articulate it like that necessarily.
No, they don't. Although I was thinking of people who sometimes will say, well, I have this homosexual friend at work and that just would be bigoted. You know, and I have love lines. I love this person, or I love my brother who's gay, or I love somebody who's a lesbian. And it becomes this thing. I'll be mean if I become a Christian. There are some people who actually do think like that. I'd be mean like you, as if it's mean to embrace God's design for male and female.
Right.
Yeah. So now when you talk about the existence of God, obviously you also have to deal with Jesus Christ, the problem of Jesus, as you say, and the problem of the Christ myth. Now, this is interesting. What is the difference between the problem of Jesus and the problem of the Christ myth?
Yeah, those are two separate chapters. So the problem of Jesus is more about, you know, is he who he said he was? He claimed to do these things. He claimed to be these things. What are you going to kind of do with Jesus? You know, as the liar, lunatic, Lord options kind of present themselves to you, kind of wind the book up with that and a story about my grandfather and how he kind of had a self-chosen slavery a bit because he was enslaved to this pleasure. And when we went in to kind of say, hey, you know, we want to free you from this thing, he didn't want it because he had a few years left and he said he'd rather live in comfort. These people were kind of taking his money from his bank account and all that. And I was just saying that a lot of people will look at the issue of Jesus and say, you know, I'm just happy kind of where I am. I don't need to deal with this. Where the problem of the Christ myth is a specific issue that has become popular over the last bunch of years, especially online, university campuses, where people look back into Horus, Mithras, Dionysus, Krishna, all of these ancient gods that predate Jesus, before Christianity ever existed. And they claim, you know, there's this very popular movie called Zeitgeist. Yes. Also, Bill Maher's Religious movie talks about this. And it's pretty popular out on the street, you know, where they say all these guys had the same basic characteristics of Jesus. And they list all of these things. Born on December 25th, crucified between two thieves, raised on the third day, fed 5,000 people, walked on water, 12 disciples, called the Lamb of the light of the world, the Lamb of God. All of these things that were before Jesus, ergo, Jesus is just another myth. He's not. He was never actually a historical person. He's based on, you know, the stars and how there were these three kings that followed this star and landed on December 25th. All of these mythologies were long before Jesus, and Christianity is just a bunch of people coming together and creating that. So the chapter goes through all of those myths and actually shows, A, that those aren't parallels with Christianity at all.
No.
Because, of course, Jesus wasn't born, and no Christian actually believes Jesus was born on December 25th.
No.
No Christian believes that three kings, you know, visited Jesus. We get that because we mess it up. It never says there was three. It
No.
says there was, you know, a group of people. Could have been two, could have been 45. We have no idea. And so anyway, so I go through and I debunk all of these parallels and show that they're not actually parallels by either showing that in those stories they weren't parallels or in Christianity they're not.
That's really helpful. And I'm really glad you're doing that because you hear these sorts of things all the time. And I always think to myself, that takes much more faith than believing in Jesus. You had 500 eyewitnesses to the resurrection. You have ancient sources confirming. You have 60 some thousand manuscripts and scrolls of the Bible. You have a lot of evidence for the historical Jesus. Even, you know, it's if they just want to say, no, I don't even want to look at that. And in some cases, they don't even know that that existence, all the historical evidence is in existence.
Yes, totally. Yeah, and I think for most, and so I have a chapter in there in the Bible that goes through exactly all of that, all the documents, and shows that the Bible is the most celebrated, trusted text in antiquity compared to all of that. And so it really equips Christians to go, okay, first, I really believe this stuff, and this is a good reminder about why. And then secondly, it equips them to actually be able to defend it to their family, to their friends, to their coworkers, whether it's issues of the Bible or sex or exclusivity or evil and suffering, you know, whatever those issues are. It really helps to do both those things.
Absolutely. Well, it's called The Problem of God. Mark Clark joining us. Mark, it was great to talk to you. I'm so glad you were able to join us. Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. God bless you. Thanks, Mark. And we'll be back on Janet Meffer Today. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is sponsored by Preborn. We want to save 300 babies' lives by giving their moms free ultrasounds, and you can help. Your gift of $140 will give free ultrasounds to five young women. Please help by calling 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or go to preborn.com. Back on Janet Meffer Today. Thank you so much for being with us. So, five transgender people serving in the U.S. military have now sued President Trump and top Pentagon officials, and they are asking that transgender troops be allowed to stay in the military. They say that this is their constitutional right. There is some disagreement on that, but my next guest, Penny Nance, CEO and President of Concerned Women for America, has written a great piece, Do Transgender Rights Trump Women's Rights? The Left Needs to Decide. This is over at FoxNews.com. And Penny joins us now. Great to have you here, Penny.
Well, it's great being on with you, Janet.
Are you surprised at all that these transgender service members quickly filed suit against President Trump?
No, not at all. I mean, I would fully expect if I were advising them on, you know, on their team, which I obviously am not, that would make sense that that would be the next political move in order to try to push back on, you know, new regulations that are forthcoming.
Right. Yeah, but what about this issue of constitutional rights? I don't remember anything in the Bill of Rights about being able to serve in the military if you have some sort of gender dysphoria issue.
Well, and there are all sorts of reasons that people are disqualified from service. It's not a right to serve, of course. It's a privilege, and it's a really hard job. And the people that are in the military do so because they're patriots and they want to serve their nation. But even as kind-hearted and as willing as some people are, they still don't make the cut. You know, I have often thought, boy, I wish I'd served. Well, it's too late for me. I'm too old. If I went down right now to recruiter and said, hey, I'd like to help out, they'd say, no, thanks. Sorry, that ship's sailed for you. And there, you know, there's other physical limitations that disqualify you. So, and illnesses and all sorts of reasons why that people are not compatible with service. A lot of it has to do with their ability to deploy.
Yeah.
And the issue of, you know, transitioning means a surgery and 11 months worth of, at least, worth of treatment that makes you completely non-deployable. And by the way, the surgery is $40,000 to $50,000. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big burden. Yes, it's a small group of people, but not everyone is compatible with service. You cannot be able to serve and deploy if you're in the middle of a transition, you know, surgery. So it's difficult, and we understand.
It is. Well, and you bring up a really good point in your piece when you're saying, what about women's rights? I mean, when you go back to Title IX and you see why Title IX was put into place, talk about this transgender issue in light of Title IX and its original intent, Penny, because I think people really need to understand this.
Well, I mean, the point I'm making in the piece is that we really are in a post-feminist era when originally you had women who fought so hard for the idea that women in sports needed equal opportunity. They needed equal representation. And people have different opinions on Title IX, but here's what it was essentially about. The federal government and the court said under, you know, under Title IX that, or through Title IX, that the money that a school district had for sports, that they had to have equal representation. They had to spend essentially the same on men as women. You couldn't favor one group over another. You know,
right.
This is our tax dollars, and, you know, women pay taxes just like men, and they have a right to compete. Well, unfortunately, what we found now is you have these elite athletes, and by the way, young women are competing so that they can enjoy college scholarships later.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, you have this situation where we have young men coming in competing against women, whether they've had, you know, in many cases, not even had the surgery, but they're transitioning, they come, and they win, and they take away the ability for women to compete fairly because, let's be honest, that men physiologically and biologically are able to compete better.
Of course.
And this is within, you know, elite athletes all recognize this. This is not a question. We understand. So the idea that suddenly it is a woman can't compete with other women, she has to compete against a man in order to win. She can't win.
No.
Even if she's the most elite athlete, woman athlete in her region,
That's
she
true.
Still can't win.
Right.
And we also saw, we're talking about it earlier, in the military, that we have seen an announcement that there's been the first woman Navy SEAL, which women are competing. And again, depending, regardless of what you think about women in combat, now they can serve in combat. So women are working to qualify for these most elite status, to be Army Rangers, to be Navy SEALs. And it's very, very difficult. The vast majority of men could never qualify. They can't meet the standards. And the standards are very high, and they should stay very high. They
Yes.
should not be lowered in order to accommodate anyone. But and so now the question is, when's going to be the first woman that's going to be the first Navy SEAL? Well, the announcement was made, well, we already have had one. Well, no, actually, it is someone who was a man while serving and transitioned later. So my question is, what about those women that are now competing? It diminishes them to say, no, actually, you're not the first.
Right.
Well, you know, they are.
Right.
And I think that the feminists would do well to recognize how this debate steals something. It's gender appropriation. You're stealing something of my identity when you walk in and subsume this role, this identity, that you doesn't belong to you.
Exactly.
It's not yours.
Exactly. And underneath all of that, I think, is the reluctant admission, even from women who are left-leaning, that, hey, that's a guy. I mean, he may be wearing women's clothing or may have had hormone injections, but he's a guy. This isn't fair.
Well,
and yet they're not speaking up as much. Yep.
The first, conversations, I think, about appropriation was based on racial appropriation. And the fact that, you can't understand the African-American experience simply by wearing clothes that people attribute, the stereotypes that attributed to that community.
Right.
Even if try to, assume an identity that you sound more black, or you wear clothes that, young black men wear, or whatever, you're still not black. You don't know what it feels like to be them. And so you're stealing that identity. You had the situation of the woman who said that she identified as black and was even leading the NAACP.
Yeah.
Rachel, I'm blanking on her last name.
Dole is all, yeah.
Yeah, she's not, just because she identifies as black does not make her black. And so to talk about, that is stealing in order to take away that identity for yourself, because it is not yours. And I would say the same, you can't simply wear women's clothes and be a woman. And we've seen men who are these, gender culture warriors who don't even bother to shave.
They're officially scared
and they've got a man's, woman's clothing. So therefore they're pushing the boundaries of what it means to be a woman. I'm like, you're ridiculous, because you have no idea what it means to be me.
Yeah. And even if you have some sort of mutilation operation, as other people have pointed out, you can't ever understand the inner workings of a female. You don't have the parts that women have inside your body. You can't carry a baby. So you really don't have. And this is what is so frustrating when they talk about erasing the gender binary. And this is all part and parcel of the LGBT movement. And we have to get rid of all these barriers. And who are you to tell me what I am and what I'm not? What this really does, though, Penny, and it's so dangerous, I think, is it's not compassionate to those people who truly have a mental disorder. And it's amazing to me that the same side of the aisle that screams about science and settled science is not being honest about the science here.
Well, I think there is an exploitation that's going on of a community of people who are seriously struggling. And I do mean they are struggling, and they deserve our love and they deserve our compassion. But you can't ask me to suspend disbelief and essentially, deny truth.
Right.
I feel like sometimes the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't pretend. And unfortunately, what I'm writing about in this piece is there's consequences to pretending. There's consequences, and we're erasing women's spaces. And these spaces are important. We tend our children in the ladies' room. We check on each other. We have hard conversations. there's a lot that happens.
It's so true. Yep. Hang on, Penny, hang on just for a moment. We're going to go to a quick break. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today with Penny Nance from Concerned Women for America. Stay with us. Isn't that a beautiful sound? That sonogram holds the sound of a baby's heartbeat. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and I'd like to introduce you to the Ministry of Preborn. Preborn's mission is to provide free ultrasounds for young moms in pregnancy centers all around America for free, and they need your help. You can help Preborn save precious lives by sponsoring ultrasounds. Ultrasound is a game changer. By letting a mom hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time. For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes to saving babies. You can save a baby's life right here in America by donating to Preborn. Join Janet Mefford today and let's save 300 babies this summer. Will you help us? 855-601-BABY is the number to call, or donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Please call 855-601-2229. That's 855-601-BABY.
Do you want to experience a closer relationship with God today? Well, the good news is God desires intimacy with you more than you could ever imagine. This is Jeannie Nigro with Unshaken. If you want to grow closer to God, you simply need to think what He thinks and feel what He feels about everything, and that includes Israel. God is passionate about Israel, so much so that out of all His creation, He chose Jerusalem to be the place of His throne forever, and Israel to be a light to the nations. When you share His passion and support Israel in your conversations, social media, prayers, and finances, you experience greater intimacy with God. And intimacy with God is the number one anchor you need to stand strong today. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's JeanneNigro.com/Janet.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Penny Nance, CEO and President of Concerned Women for America. You can check her out more at CapitolHillBrief.org, her wonderful feature that you hear each day. Penny, you have a really good take on this. I think you've got this piece at FoxNews.com. Do transgender rights trump women's rights? The left needs to decide. And you made the smart comment that there are consequences to pretending. And that's really what's going on here. There is a fiction that we are being required to accept that is ridiculous. It is the emperor has no clothes. The little kid saying, well, wait a minute, that king isn't dressed out in a big robe. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the consequences and what the consequences really are when we embrace that fiction.
Well, unfortunately, the consequences are borne mostly by women, because if we lose our safe spaces, and, you know, I understand that that term is overused, but we need our spaces. I mean, I was referring earlier before the break to ladies' rooms. You know, we nurse our children there. We take care of each other there. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a essential role for women to have privacy.
Yes.
And if I'm not allowed to object to a man with a full beard, and this is what they're saying, walking into my restroom that is, you know, today looks like a man, but today feels like a woman, then I do not have a safe space. And if that makes me bigoted to raise an objection, then I'm being bullied into, you know, a silence that at the end of the day makes women less safe.
Yeah.
Because, you know, by the way, there are, for every man that, there are many more heterosexual sexual predators in the world than there are transgender people.
Right.
Honestly.
Right.
I mean, you look at the numbers on the sexual predator registry around the country. I used to know that number. 800,000, I want to say, something like a very large number. So safety is an issue, not from transgender people, but by evil people who will use any excuse to hurt and abuse.
Absolutely.
But then there's the other issue of the culture of women having quiet spaces that we are able to come together and take care of each other and take care of our own needs. Yeah. And so I think we are giving up something by ignoring that.
Yes.
And I would, you know, really, you know, defy the feminists to say that that is not true. And in fact, honestly, many are beginning to say that. There is a crack within this movement of women saying, wait a minute, I supported Title IX because I thought women should have their ability to compete and to win and to get college, scholarships and to be able to achieve. Well, if you have to go up against a man, you probably aren't going to win,
right,
even if you're the very best.
That's true. It's true. And when you look at the bathrooms, I always say, do we need one more person standing in that long line? Don't we have enough problems to the airports or whatever, sporting events? That's my number one.
They're going to change their mind quickly.
I was going to say, you might change your mind on your bathroom choice once you go to a sporting event and try to stand in the women's line. I mean, it's true, though. It's true, though. And when you talk about things like nursing your baby and changing your baby, all of which, you know, we've both done for years, mm-hmm, in bathrooms, mm-hmm, and just feeling safe, doing your makeup and all that, it changes, mm-hmm, the dynamic when a guy walks in. And you, mm-hmm, might not even, this is a point too, Penny, and I'm curious for your position on this. One of the things that I've brought up over the years is if a man has gone through a sex change operation, mm-hmm, and you can't tell,
you're not
going to know. So why do you need laws?
Or if you suspect, you don't care. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
I
just had this happen actually recently in Dallas Airport. I'm standing at the sink, applying lipstick and complaining to the woman, who was actually a guy next to me, about the lighting. We're both complaining to each other. He weighs maybe 100 pounds. Mm. Like, there was nothing threatening about him.
Right.
And he had done, it obviously had gone to a lot of trouble to, you know, that is not, and I guarantee you, before we had this conversation so often and so much, I would have never even noticed him before.
Right.
You know, and how many times have I didn't know. Honestly, here's where the exploitation comes in. They need to raise money. LGBTQ group activists won on gay marriage, and now they need the next thing.
Yes.
And so this has to be a thing in order for them to continue to raise money and to have a reason to exist.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. They keep moving the goalposts so the human rights campaign can keep the millions flowing in. It's true.
That's true.
I mean, and I don't know how many people realize that. So it's good when you say that feminists have begun to crack a little bit and some are beginning to stand up, especially when you have men who are thinking they're women allowed to compete in women's sports. What do you think is the tipping point, Penny, or is there a tipping point for feminists to fully come out and say, all right, fine, we're on board with the LGBT agenda, except for this. You guys, this is a bridge too far. We're not with you. Do you think there will be that point at which the big feminists will stand up?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's already, as I said, there's already a fracture there. And you would think when men start to get voted Woman of the Year, I mean, that happened when Bruce Jenner was made, or Caitlyn Jenner was made Woman of the Year by, I forget who voted in Cosmo or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you had women saying, okay, he hasn't had the surgery, but even if he has, he's only been a woman for about 10 minutes. So, like, what could he possibly have done so far for us?
Yeah.
And I think I'm starting to hear those conversations more frequently. And I think for us to have the conversation about gender appropriation, I think is a fair and thoughtful one, because it does cost us something. And are we willing to give away our femininity that cheaply?
Yeah.
I'm not.
Good. That's good. And, you know, when we bring the Christian worldview to bear on these issues of male and female, we know this is absolutely fundamental. I know CWA is heavily involved in the defense of the family and, mm-hmm, and having people really stand up for these important issues. What is most important, do you think, for believers to understand about fighting for the way God designed both male and female and the family as he designed it?
Well, I mean, there is a sense of rebellion against God's design, right? It's real. And it's also, I think it's really important for people to understand the philosophical underpinnings of this. And it's Gnosticism.
Yes, it is.
And Gnosticism isn't new. Like,
right,
it's been around since biblical times. And there are, you know, the ancient Greeks were dealt with that issue. And so in the Bible, Paul went to great lengths to talk about, and he didn't specifically name it, but he spoke against the principles of Gnosticism. So I would suggest that Christians take the time to read about that and to try to understand. Concern Women for America has Young Women for America college chapters. We have about 40 of those now and growing. We have a basic lesson on that issue, on the issue of transgender, that goes into the issue of Gnosticism and the philosophy behind it, and also even some of the science, but very thoughtfully and with humility and with kindness. And that has to be the way that we think and talk about all of these issues, because you've got to realize and understand and believe that we are in a hurting world with hurting people.
We sure are.
Come at it from that standpoint first and foremost.
Yeah, such an important point, Penny. I've been talking about that myself, the influence of Gnosticism, because I think for a lot of believers, they say, why is this going on? Well,
think it's new.
Yeah, they think it's new. And they say, is there some spiritual reason other than rejecting God? Well, yes, but there's also a name for it, what you said, and this idea that, you can transcend your body and what is around us needs to be deconstructed. And really, you look back to this, and when you see what CWA is doing all across the country, as you've mentioned with all your different chapters, you are standing for Christ in a way that is so important for us to do at this period of time. And I'm wondering if you really feel that every day. Wow, we really do exist for such a time as this.
Well, we do. And, I call this an Esther moment. And I think it's essential for women particularly, because we're able to come at these issues from a way that's different from men. And we should not be afraid to do that, because, we're called to it. We're called to be the Esthers of this generation, and we can do so thoughtfully and prayerfully and with kindness. And so, my book, Feisty and Feminine, specifically was written to equip women to lean into the hard conversations. We're having hard conversations at this time, but I think women do it particularly well. And we're able to do it in a way, I hope, that brings people to our side, or at least allows them to see our heart, and that our heart is for them and for good and truth and righteousness. But we have to make sure that our hearts are right as we lean into these conversations, that we've got to have them. It's important.
Absolutely right. Well, Penny Nance, CEO and president over at Concerned Women for America, check out CapitolHillBrief.org. It's always an honor to have you, Penny. Thank you.
God bless.
God bless you, too. Take care. We appreciate Concerned Women for America so very much. Check them out again, CapitolHillBrief.org. And thanks for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time.